Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, hello and welcome along to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. It's that time of the week here on Premier Christian Radio when we meet a Christian with a really interesting life story. I'm going to be introducing you to Pete Portal in just a moment, author of a new book called No Neutral Ground. But if you'd like more episodes of The Profile, don't forget we're available as a podcast wherever you find podcasts from. And you can also find more interesting interviews with all kinds of Christians in all walks of life from Premier Christianity magazine. If you want to get a free sample copy of the latest edition of the magazine, you can get one at premierchristianity.com/free-sample. I'm Justin Brierley, and today my guest on the programme is Pete Portal. Welcome along to the programme, Pete.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you on. I've known about your story for a little while, actually, because when I was the editor of Premier Christianity magazine, we featured you and Sarah in the magazine talking about this extraordinary story, which you've now kind of given us the chance to have a bit more depth into with this new book of your journey. Moving to South Africa, establishing this extraordinary ministry to drug addicts, gang members, and just about the incredible highs and lows that has involved. We'll talk about No Neutral Ground, Finding Jesus in a Cape Town Ghetto is the subtitle of this new book of yours. But I want to talk about how things started off for you, first of all. Because you grew up in a pretty kind of normal British environment, born in London, sort of white middle class kind of family. And no Christian kind of context whatsoever for what you were doing, for the kind of life you kind of had in your early days.
I grew up in sort of southeast London, middle class family. We attended church, but it meant nothing to me. Mm. I was a chorister for 5 years, but it wasn't the Anglican spirituality that did anything for me particularly. Mm. I loved the music, but... Mm. No, faith-wise, we were church attenders, I would say, or I was, more than anything, yeah. More than that. Yeah.
It wasn't something that you had sort of come alive for yourself, and we'll come to how it did do that. It was interesting to read, though, in the book that you attended this Westminster Abbey Choir School, and that involved, you know, all of the great state occasions and everything. Even you, I think you were in the boys choir that sang at Princess Diana's funeral.
Yeah.
But even in that situation where you effectively were going to church 8 times a week, I think none of it really sunk in terms of any of the actual truths of Christianity. It kind of went over your head to some level.
Yeah, totally. We were engaged in a performance. Mm. from the age of 8 to 13. It was drilled into you how to pronounce various words, the enunciation of the Latin or the Nicene Creed or whatever it might be. And quite honestly, that's not particularly conducive to sort of heartfelt faith, or it wasn't for me as a preteen, which, so faith-wise, no, it wasn't a faith experience of any kind.
And even though there was a confirmation process, again, it wasn't something that really actually meant much to you in terms of any kind of living faith.
No, just something that we did. Yeah.
So what was it that brought you to a living faith in the end? Because there's quite an interesting story behind this.
Yeah. Well, it was a complete accident. I was at a public school in Kent, and on the weekends we had managed to, friends of mine and I, at the age of 15, had managed to get our hands on some fake ID cards and put the wrong date of birth in, and use these to get in to all the bars and clubs in.
Were you a bit of a naughty boy?
In a very cosseted middle class privileged way, I suppose. But no, not really. I don't think I can. Don't really I can say that. But just doing stuff teenagers did, you know, and messing around and rebelling in whatever safe ways we could find to do, and ended up at the end of a night in a takeaway on Seven Oaks High Street, and ended up getting into a fight with the manager of one of the pubs there. And
you foolishly let slip that you'd got in with these.
Yeah. We'd been boasting, and I stupidly showed him this this fake ID that we had made, and he was like, "Well, actually, I'm the manager of the pub you were last in. You're barred, and I'm going to report you." And so we ended up getting in a fight. And there was a guy in the corner of the takeaway who split up the fight, mm-hmm. And sort of sent me on my way. And I didn't think anything of it, really, mm-hmm. Until the next week, for whatever reason, my mum had signed me up for a sort of church youth camp.
Okay.
My older sister had come to faith through this church, and I think my mum had recognized that this was a good thing, and I probably needed a bit of, I don't know, whatever it was my older sister had mm-hmm. got. Mm-hmm. And I turned up, turned off my mobile phone, because I knew nothing about really what this was going to involve, apart from it wasn't the cool thing to do, go on church camp. And turned off my phone so no one could get in touch with me during the week. And as I climbed aboard the bus, the guy ticking the names off was the guy in the takeaway the week before who had split up the fight.
Right.
And again, I had no sort of grid to put it on, faith-wise, but something in my spirit, I think, realized that, you know, God had got my attention.
This was significant in some way.
It was significant.
And that week was significant because I think it was that week where you finally understood what Christianity is about.
Right. And I had heard the Gospel of Mark taught clearly and coherently and without sort of denominational this and that, so I may have got it previously. Just a clear gospel message, but also the witness of the young people who were there, who were my age from similar backgrounds, but actually weren't essentially hiding their own insecurity as I was with various behaviors that, you know. And so I was fascinated. I thought, well, I've heard this message of this guy Jesus that everyone's saying is true, but yet when I look at their lives, actually, like this makes sense. I want what they've got.
Yeah. I mean, this would lead you on a journey of really starting your Christian faith at that point, through obviously secondary school, where I think a lot of people, you know, were pretty skeptical and made fun of it, but did eventually take you to studying theology at university.
Yeah.
And I guess into a kind of Christian life in your early 20s, where you were kind of, you know, you believed it all, you went to church, but you were sort of not, well, tell us how things happened, how the direction started to move in terms of thinking about South Africa and all of that as well.
Yeah, well, I was studying religious studies at Edinburgh. I kind of panicked. I didn't know what to study at university and figured that would be a good thing to do. And that wasn't theology so much as comparative religions, phenomenology and ancient Hebrew and things like that. It just seemed a bit more interesting to me. And it was at Edinburgh that I made friends with a guy called Andy, who invited me on a short-term mission trip to South Africa. And I ended up going to South Africa based on his invite.
There's another interesting story about you not being particularly interested to begin with in this idea of a short-term mission trip to South Africa.
Not at all. No, I was working at the CBBC at the time, assembling giant pogo sticks for the live studio show and working out how best to gunge people's parents. And that was really what I wanted to spend my life doing, I thought. And so when he said, come to South Africa, and I said no, and he tried to sweeten the deal by saying, we're going to go into prisons and work with gang members, I thought, well, you're not, you know, this is not at all I want to be doing.
Yeah.
And God conspired to get me there. And
tell us the story, because it is a fun story of how God sort of semi-twisted your arm to get you out there.
Well, as I say, I had no interest in South Africa. I was interested in working in TV. And but when he said, will you come? And I said, no. He played what, you know, I now call the Christian Trump card. He said, well, will you at least pray about it?
And so I thought, you can't say no.
No, I can't say
you?
No. Yeah, and I did. Right. And, you know, no epiphany. Apart from a week later, I got a letter in the post from the NHS saying that here's the date for your shoulder operation that I've been waiting months for. And the proposed date was slap bang in the middle of the proposed trip to South Africa. So
great excuse. God's confirmed I can't do the trip.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he used the NHS to show that, you know. And then Andy said, well, why don't you phone them? And I thought, for goodness sake, you know. But I ended up phoning the shoulder consultant's secretary and clocked that she had an unfamiliar accent. And I said, I'm just phoning to see if it's possible to change the operation date. And she said, well, it's not going to be easy, but why? And I said, well, I want to go on a short-term mission trip. And she goes, oh, where to? And I said, South Africa. She goes, I'm from South Africa. What sort of trip was it? I said, oh, it's a Christian mission trip. She says, oh, I'm a Christian. Where in South Africa? And I said, town outside Cape Town called Paarl. And she goes, I'm from Paarl. And then she said, I think God might want you to go on this trip, which is not something you necessarily hear from a consultant secretary. So I figured, again, a bit like the previous story, God had just got my attention.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, my spirit recognized that there was something in this. And I kind of, begrudgingly went along, recognizing that probably it would be disobedient not to. And then, yeah, that changed everything.
Yeah. And you experienced on that trip, as naive and, you know, innocent in a sense as you were kind of thrown in at the deep end, but you experienced what it looks like or feels like to live in a spiritual war zone at some level. Because I think it was really during that time that you kind of got to grips with praying.
Right.
Because suddenly there was really stuff to pray about.
Yeah, exactly. At this point. There were nine of us in this student group between the ages of 18 and 22 or something. I mean, so young. And there are three rooms in this house that we were staying in a community on the Cape Flats, and which we'll talk about in a bit, I'm sure. And so some bright spark said, why don't we put all the guys in one room, all the girls in another room, and the third bedroom we'll have as a 24-hour prayer room. And I thought, what a questionable use of a third room. You know, like, we're going to be exhausted, surely.
Be nice to have some extra space.
Yeah, you know.
For bedrooms, yeah.
But day by day, we went out to a prison, Drakenstein prison, that used to be called Victor Verster, which was where Mandela was released from after his time in Polsmoor. And we heard the stories of the prison gangsters, and we worked in an informal settlement, and we returned back to the Cape Flats every day and heard gunshots and saw the teenagers on heroin and crystal meth. And it was a couple of days in, as we were sitting in the prayer room late at night, kind of weeping for this nation, that we realized what a great use of space this was.
Yes, yeah.
And really, that was 6 weeks. Yeah. 6 weeks of God depositing his heart for a city and a nation that I then couldn't shut up about after I returned to London.
And in a sense, I think that went quite deep down into you, even as you went back to kind of normal sort of middle-class evangelical Christian life. You write in the book how you were ticking all the required boxes of respectable middle class guy in his early 20s, but there was this kind of gnawing sense there's got to be more than this, and you were constantly being drawn back to what happened in South Africa, and is that where God's calling me?
Right. I didn't know what constituted a calling particularly, apart from I was angry about what I'd seen, and there seemed to be a need, and I could use whatever skills I may or may not have and kind of bring them all together. And, you know, that seemed to work for me. And I had nothing keeping me in London at that point. No job, no mortgage, no partner or anything. So I just figured, if ever I'm going to do it, now's the time. And there was no reason for anyone in London to be equally worked up as I was, because I had been exposed to something. And I think when God exposes us to things, that comes with a responsibility to respond.
And I think we'll talk about the way your theology and thinking has all developed in the decade or more that you've been out there, because I think that there's some really interesting stuff that we'll cover about the fact that you now recognize some of what you were getting into could have looked rather patronizing, like the white savior kind of going to save people in another country sort of thing. But at that point, you were sort of naive but very enthusiastic and willing to go wherever God called you. And I think also I get the sense in the book that you were starting to experience something new about the way God moves as well, because I think you'd been sort of converted into a fairly sort of conservative evangelical kind of tradition, but you actually started to witness some quite out there miraculous stuff going on. I think you went on a trip to India as a supposed cameraman who sort of managed to wangle a place of videoing this sort of healing sort of mission. And but what you saw kind of blew your mind a bit, didn't it?
Yeah, that was an interesting one. So I went to South Africa long term at the beginning of 2009, but the end of 2008, I just had another shoulder operation. My shoulders kept dislocating. And saw a friend put on Facebook, you know, we're looking for a cameraman to film a mission trip. Anyone interested? And I thought, well, I've done some pretty rudimentary stuff at CBBC. You know, I could...
That qualifies me. Surely.
Yeah, I could put myself forward. And they were up for it. And I used my final paycheck to buy a ticket to India and borrowed a camera and, you know, sort of looked through the instruction manual on the plane and kind of worked out how to do it. And for a couple of weeks, saw the most, well, quite honestly, normal manifestations of Christianity, but for me at the time seemed completely wacky. Demonic deliverances and physical healings and everything
else. You described one that really caught my attention, which was a mum with a baby.
Yes, yeah.
And the baby born blind without eyes, essentially. Well,
the baby wasn't even born blind. The baby was born with no eyes in its eye sockets.
Right, so literally no eyeballs.
No eyeballs.
Yeah.
And she brought him to us, his little boy, I think, and we had our interpreter standing next to us, and the baby just looked like he was asleep.
Mm.
And we thought, oh, great, you know, maybe she wants us to bless the baby, or I don't know, there was... there are difficulties in short-term mission, yeah, which we'll get to. But sure. The interpreter just said, no eyes.
Okay.
You know, no eyes. Right. What do you want me to do about that? And I just feel myself sweating. I thought, oh, for goodness sake, this can't be right, you know. And I was, you know, with the camera and stuff, and there was a bunch of others around. But I actually put the camera down and got involved, and we laid hands on the baby, didn't know what to do. All we knew was pray, Jesus heals sickness, nothing we can do, which are probably the best criteria for anything happening anyway. And prayed and prayed and prayed, nothing. And the mother had kind of prized the eyelids open. And before us, eyeballs began to grow. A creative miracle happening as we prayed. Little black circles that then grew and grew and grew until the baby had eyes. I have never seen anything like it before or since.
No.
Except God heals, and it's no more supernatural for him to do that than to take away your headache.
Wow. It extraordinary, but in a sense laid the ground perhaps for thinking, okay, God can do amazing things.
Right.
And obviously this was in the context of you starting to dream this dream with your friend Andy of going to South Africa and starting something new. As naive and unprepared for it as you both were,
right.
Nonetheless, that you knew you felt you were being called. And yeah. The place you felt you were being called to, which many people may not be familiar with this name, but was Manenberg.
Yeah.
Which, as you've described in the book, is one of the most notorious ghettos of Cape Town. So why Manenberg?
Well, we moved over to South Africa. We were with a mission organization that was great, but we had no particular connection to, apart from we thought we should join something official. And that's what people told us. So we thought, great, okay, we'll do that. You know, we were so clueless. It was only a few months in that we were actually introduced to an organization in Cape Town called The Warehouse that really seeks to serve the church, local church, in its response to poverty and injustice and division in Cape Town. And as we got to know people there, we met a guy called Jonathan, who's from Manenberg, and he was talking to us about long-term discipleship of gangsters and drug addicts, rather than the sort of smash-and-grab Christianity of going into villages like we had done previously, and sort of getting people to raise their hands and then leaving again.
Yeah.
And that just resonated with us, and we thought, show us this place. Yeah. And hopped in the car with him, drove down the road, and ended up driving around Manenberg. And that it was a complete accident. It wasn't like, this is where we want to go. We'd never heard of it, really. It was just, this is where God has given us a relationship. This is someone doing amazing stuff. We want to join. Yeah. What's going on?
But Manenberg is kind of one of those places that's spoken of in South Africa with a why would anyone want to go there kind of a place. Why is that? Why has it got that reputation?
Well, it's funny because it's the irony of apartheid spatial planning is such that Manenberg is one junction away from the airport. So you have all, you know, the townships around the airport, and the closest to the airport are those who are least likely to ever get on an aeroplane. But if you go to Cape Town and you rent a car from the airport and they ask for the address and you say Manenberg, so many of our friends who've come to visit have described the
the look of shock and bewilderment.
Yeah, are you sure you don't mean Musenberg? Or are you sure you don't mean, you know? Yeah, Manenberg has a rough reputation, for sure. And it's often described as an apartheid dumping ground because it shouldn't exist in the first place. Manenberg exists because the apartheid regime forcibly removed hundreds of thousands of people of color from the foot of Table Mountain in the southern suburbs and built dormitory-style housing for them 20, 30 kilometers outside of town. And
out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. And railways and highways were used to kind of... what I kind of see is a sort of botched face job of a city with these sort of lines of pain and scars everywhere that keeps Cape Coloured, which is a local term for those of mixed race, away from Xhosa, black
people. So you could literally be on the wrong side of the tracks in that kind of scenario.
Yeah, and actually nothing has changed really, particularly in Cape Town. But anyway, so the current scene in Manenberg is one of pandemic gangs and drug abuse, which really someone explained to me in relation to another conflict, what collective trauma looks like. And if your home was bulldozed 50 years ago by the regime and you grew up now in Manenberg, of course your collective trauma response would be to defend your turf. It's really quite an obvious thing. And so then gangs spring up.
Yeah.
And
and that is
them,
the way
that comes with them,
that a lot of these young men and boys and women get their meaning, and their community is in a gang, and it's in looking for that purpose and I suppose solidarity within structures that are often obviously very destructive, but it's the only reality that is on offer very often, presumably. And you say in the book that, and this is kind of where the title of the book comes from, that every square inch of Manenberg is basically owned by a gang of some kind or another. There's no neutral ground in that sense.
Right.
But what do you mean by no neutral ground?
Well, what I mean by no neutral ground is when we say yes to following Jesus, we can no longer live in a way that just palely reflects the way we've been living beforehand. Someone once said, I don't know who, but if you're live in such a way that if God exists, your life wouldn't make sense. And I was in London, I was tired of living in a way that my life made complete sense. Actually, it was reasonable. It was, you know, fairly passive. And as I say, it was a pale reflection of everyone else's around me. And for me, when we come to know Jesus, we have a choice, an invitation to die to self and invade systemic injustice with the kingdom of Jesus, which looks like love and looks like embrace and looks like belonging.
You start the preface of the book with that quote from C.S. Lewis: there is no neutral ground in the universe. Every square inch, every split second is claimed by God and counterclaimed by Satan.
Yeah.
And Jesus says similar words, obviously, in Matthew. You quote from the Message here, that this is war and there is no neutral ground. If you're not on my side, you're the enemy. If you're not helping, you're making things worse. And I get that sense in the rest of the book almost. You're talking about like a spiritual war zone that you're entering, as well as a physical war zone very often. So what was that like in those early days? I mean, again, full of naive optimism. And tell us about what went right and what went badly wrong.
Well, what went right is probably easier to tell because there's less of that. But we prayer walked. Andy and I prayer walked with Jono for 6 hours a week for the best part of a year. And he walked with us along gang territories and through various conflict zones, because Manenberg's really a community on the brink of perpetual civil war with itself the whole time. And we prayed. And we met people along the way who would ask us, what are you doing? And Jono would explain, and we would begin to pick up some Afrikaans as we did it. And in walking, we began to meet young men. And at the end of the first year, four of them had made commitments to follow Jesus. And really powerfully received the Holy Spirit, a couple of them particularly. Sort of Dwayne came off heroin, eventually painlessly through baptism of the Holy Spirit, and another guy called Kevin got filled with the Holy Spirit in his mother's shack as he was repenting of everything that had gone before. And so we saw these amazing little snippets of or little sort of glimpses of the kingdom's light breaking through. And that was because we were soaked in prayer. We could do nothing else. But as time went on, we began to see each one of those young men fall away.
Right.
And we began to realize that friendship and prayer, as basic and as necessary as they are not the full picture. We needed to establish some other things to bring a sustainability and a culture conducive to healing and recovery.
Yeah. We'll talk about that in the next section of today's show, because you've got some extraordinary stories, but they are stories that are both full of joy and hope, but also great disappointment and frustration.
Yeah.
And that is the reality of the world we face. And we'll obviously talk about Sarah, who's your wife now, and obviously all the difference that that made in, as you joined your lives together in this endeavor. So my guest on the show today is Pete Portal. This is Justin Brierley presenting the profile today. And you're going to continue to hear some extraordinary stories of his life and Sarah's life in Cape Town, in one of the most notorious ghettos, Manenberg. And it's all been put down in his new book, No Neutral Ground, Finding Jesus in a Cape Town Ghetto. I've been reading it. It's a stunning book. Do go and get it. And we'll be continuing this conversation in a short moment's time.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue,
Old Testament stories containing the torture, rape, or murder of women come under the spotlight. In light of the Me Too movement, we ask, as Christians, how should we read these passages today? Plus, find out what true racial diversity could look like in our churches, and discover the article your pastor wishes you'd read, but is too embarrassed to ask.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show. I'm Justin Brierley with you for The Profile. And if you want to find more interesting interviews with Christians from all walks of life, do pick up a copy of the latest edition of Premier Christianity Magazine. You can actually get a free sample copy by going online to the website, premierchristianity.com/freesample. And here on The Profile, both as a podcast and on Premier Christian Radio, it's a great joy to sit down with interesting people. And one of the most interesting that I've come across recently is my guest Pete Portal on the show today. He's the author of No Neutral Ground, Finding Jesus in a Cape Town Ghetto. It's really the story of how he and his wife Sarah have responded to the call of God to go to one of South Africa's most notorious ghettos, Manenberg. And really a challenge to Christians everywhere to risk it all for the sake of the forgotten and the most vulnerable. And Pete, it's impossible not to read a book like this and be very challenged by your story. Though, I mean, do you get a sense of frustration when you come back to the UK and see effectively a very sort of comfortable middle-class Christianity, which is quite obsessed with sometimes navel-gazing issues, probably, compared to the kinds of things you're meeting on a daily basis in South Africa. How do you respond to that? How do you deal with that, that kind of sense of, come on, guys, get real kind of thing?
Yeah. The short answer is yes. There's a big but, and that is that condemnation or judgment it shuts down straight away. But joy and fascination is generative and infectious. And so if we can tell a story, and there's always a temptation to tell better stories than the lives we're living, right? But if we can tell a story with integrity and with joy that acknowledges the desperate lows as well, then I think actually there's something about our human existence that longs for that. That's fullness of life. And so that's what we come and really do. We preach the gospel and we tell of the goodness of God in a place where like Nazareth, people say, Manambo, can anything good come out of Manambo?
Yeah.
And we say, absolutely. Like Nazareth, absolutely.
Before we hear the story of meeting Sarah and your joint ministry together, tell us a little bit about the journey you've been on theologically. Not only did you have that journey kind of to realizing the power of God and so on, but also, I think, a kind of academic journey to realizing the bigger picture of, I suppose, colonial influence, privilege, and the way that systemic structures, if you like, are part of the big picture of what's happened in South Africa.
Yeah.
And obviously what the implications are for you as a sort of white Western male coming over to sort of do stuff and how that's going to be received and what that looks like and so on. What has been the journey you've been on when it comes to looking at that bigger picture?
In a nutshell, the journey is, in my own mind, going from seeing Jesus as merely a personal savior to Jesus as a liberator from political and social oppression. It's not that he's one or the other, he's both. But I was only ever taught this moralistic gospel that you are bad, he's perfect, come to him and you will be made perfect. Right. Absolutely, imputed righteousness, great. But then what's the extension of that for how then we are to live? And how we then are to live is, in fulfilling the Great Commission, seeking to invade systemic injustice for the gospel. And that doesn't mean invading communities or invading culture in a colonial spirit. It means looking at whatever prevailing injustices grab us and God speaks to us through, and seeking to live our lives as a generative contradiction to whatever the prevailing status quo it might be. And so that looks different in London as it does in Manenberg. But the invitation to us is always the same, is to follow Jesus out of our comfort zones and live our life in a way that asks questions of whatever that injustice is. I once heard someone say, we're praying for justice as a church. We pray all the time for justice. And yet if we're complicit in maintaining systems of injustice, he said, we shouldn't be praying for justice. Yeah. We should be praying for mercy. And so we're all hypocrites to some extent, right? But it was a year studying political theology at King's in London, the year after Sarah and I got married, that really awakened me to liberation theology, to the writings of many great theologians that I hadn't considered before, and to the whole realm of theology, that black theology and James Cone and all of this sort of stuff.
And all of that, in a sense, quite politically charged, you know, quite in a sense, liberation theology is very much about looking at the big social issues and structures and so on, and taking it away from that slightly, moralistic, personal, get saved by Jesus kind of view. How did you kind of, what difference did that make practically to what you then, how you manifested and carried out your ministry on the ground in Cape Town? Were there things you were more conscious of what you were doing and how you were presenting yourself and the kind of Christianity you were inviting people to join in that sense?
Oh, for sure. I shut up, basically.
Right.
And I began to listen and began to find good news from the poor, as well as knowing that I was to proclaim good news to the poor.
Yeah.
And so it becomes this reciprocal, mutual liberation.
Right.
And that is the story that Sarah and I often tell of living with young men who are addicted and angry and traumatized and violent, is that there's so much beauty and so much of the gospel message we can find in living together with such people, where they then become my teachers. And that's the way it should be. And it shouldn't really be a surprise that that is the thing, but it often is.
I think you got to a point reasonably early on in your experience there where you'd suffered some disappointments and some issues, and you kind of in slight desperation said to God, I don't think I can hack this anymore. You're going to have to give me a wife or I'm going to kind of quit.
Yeah, that was remarkable. And utterly melodramatic, actually, because I was 24 at the time, had been living 5 months with Dwayne in Manenberg. 5 months. I mean, a complete emotional and
this was
spiritual.
Dwayne, who at that point had apparently come off the
he had been delivered off heroin, but had relapsed.
Right.
Yeah. And and the wheels were really coming off, and it had hit crunch time. And the only thing that hadn't gone missing was my laptop. And I said to him recently, I said, yeah, but you never got my laptop, did you? Because Dwayne's now almost 8 years clean,
right,
and is married and a father, and he's just doing great. And, you know, as an example of the transforming power of Jesus. But I said to him recently, yeah, but you never got my laptop, did you? And I said, it's because I moved it from drawer to drawer in different places around the house. And he just looked at me and he chuckled. He said, are you joking? I knew exactly where it was. I just knew that the moment I stole your laptop, the game was up.
He knew that that was the line.
Yeah. That was the line.
Wow.
And thank God he didn't, because that was... And actually, that season was the beginning of writing my book, because I would just journal and journal and journal.
Yeah.
And
you include segments from that in the book.
Indeed,
which
yeah.
is really helpful.
And part of that was, and I remember the date and the time really clearly. It was the 17th of September 2010 at about 4:30 in the afternoon. And I wrote, as you say, a prayer, really, or a moan, which are often similar, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I moaned to God and I said, I'm done with this. I'm completely exhausted, spiritually, emotionally depressed, had become a single parent to a drug addict living alone in a township. And I said in my diary, Lord, I know that you've called me here, and therefore I will give the rest of my life. I'll happily live here for the rest of my life if that's what you want for me. But the one thing I ask is that you would give me a wife to do this together with. And that was at 4:30, packed up my laptop, packed a bag, and went to a friend's house in town, because we were going to another friend's birthday party. And that evening, about 3 hours later, after praying that prayer, Sarah and I met.
Wow. And the rest is history, as they say.
Right.
Sarah, but I should say, is here with us in the studio. Unfortunately, she's not on mic. But do you want to just say hello for the audience, Sarah? Anyway, Sarah is there. But in a way, I'm sure that was being able to do this with someone by your side, and that counts for both of you, I'm sure made a big difference from that point forward to kind of this is okay. I feel like I can go forward in this now.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, that was one of the clearest and quickest answer to prayers I'd ever seen. You know, we sat that evening chatting all night around, the coltan crisis in the Congo and xenophobia and faith and our frustration with suburban church and child soldiers and the kingdom. And... We just hit it off straight away, and it was incredibly encouraging. Sarah was on her way to the Congo to work with child soldiers, and I said to her, well, come 20 minutes down the road and meet Cape Town's child soldiers. So actually our first date was in Manenberg, accidentally, trying to help Dwayne stay clean.
Yeah, and there are many, many other stories you tell in the book of the way that you and Sarah have worked together. But I mean, that's a kind of crazy life, you know, for anyone, let alone starting a married life together to kind of be involved in. How did you kind of cope with both the change in, you know, you being together and being surrounded, you know, by this kind of almost constant semi-chaos of the lives that you were involved in and trying to help and everything else? Because I can imagine that puts pressures on a relationship, right?
Yeah. I mean, the first 6 months that we were married, we weren't living in Manenberg together. Mm-hmm. I'd moved out by then. And then for the next year, we moved to London to study. And so it was only really, well, we moved in to Manenberg on our second wedding anniversary. And Sarah's mother had tragically died in 2011 and left her some money. And God spoke to us about using everything we had to create a home and habitation for His Spirit, where we could welcome young men out of gangs and drugs and do family together. And that was the sort of beginning of the next season. But it put strain on relationship. But as I said earlier, it means that there's no neutral ground even in a relationship. Mm-hmm. You have to work out your stuff. If we're trying to impart peace and healing and unity to angry young men, we cannot give it that if we're not ourselves living it.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about some of these young guys, especially that you were seeing, and what you were trying to set up with this house that you'd managed to get hold of. Is it Crew 62 that
Crew
would
62,
become known as? And eventually that came under the oversight, in a sense, of a church that you became part of as well. But tell us about some of these. I've got a number of names here, but you can choose whose story you want to tell. I've got Moinir, Shiham, and Marwan as well. They've all got unique stories that are both joyful and desperately tragic as well.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one. I mean, Manenberg is about 40% Muslim. Mm-hmm. So officially 60% Christian, 40% Muslim. Now, official statistics rarely mean anything. But all that to say, it's the worshipping community. And back in the day, I was staying with Dwayne, and he was going off to help on a church camp, which retrospectively he wasn't ready for. Mm-hmm. But I asked him if he could find a suitable friend of his who would maybe come live with me whilst he was away. And we would just carry on the same daily rhythms of reading scripture together and, you know, all the rest of it. And his friend Munir said he would come and live with me, which was very kind of him. And Munir is a Muslim. And I thought, well, you know, we'll read the scriptures. And we were reading the scriptures and going through the gospel. And I asked him one day, I said, so, you know, we'd read all about Jesus. And I said, so what do you make of this Jesus? Is this a man you would like to follow? And he said, well, of course I'd like to, but I can't for two reasons. I said, oh, why not? And he said, one is that I'm a Muslim, and that's a lifelong commitment. And the other is I'm a prison gangster. So in prison, there are the 26s, 27s, and 28 gangs. And when you make a commitment to join one of them, that is a lifelong, literally blood covenant.
Yeah.
So they were perfectly reasonable objections. And to his credit, he wasn't going to try and sort of add Christianity onto his other lifelong commitments.
Yeah.
And he said, so it's impossible. And I said, well, why don't we pray that Jesus would reveal himself to you today and show you that those two objections, whilst reasonable, actually need not preclude you from following him. So, all right, fine. He couldn't really say no, so we prayed. But that afternoon he came back and I said, so how's your day? And he said, I had a bizarre encounter. He didn't call it encounter, what do you call it? Met these guys on Manenberg Avenue. I said, oh, who is that? He said, well, these four or five guys, I forget how many now. I forget their names, but it was like Ikshan, Mansur, Muhammad, and Suleiman. And I said, okay. Well, and he said, and they had prison gang tattoos all over them. But they were Bakir, which is Afrikaans for saved, born again. And they were carrying their big Bibles. And he said, I couldn't work out how these prison gangsters who had all had Muslim names were Bakir, were following Jesus. And they came up to me and they said that God spoke to them about me and that he's opened a door in front of me and that Jesus is calling me and that I must just walk through it. And then they prayed for me. And I was absolutely dumbfounded. I thought, that's exactly...
You just prayed.
Right. But here's the thing. He didn't see it.
Hmm.
I said, so, you know, like, what are you going to do about it? And he was like, oh, I don't know. And he was on heroin at the time.
Hmm.
He's still on heroin. I saw his wife last week. He's still on heroin. And at some point, I believe his story is not over. You know, we cannot deny the miraculous encounter that he had. And God's calling him. Yeah. But he at the moment, he isn't following Jesus.
But even the widest door doesn't mean someone's going to walk through it, or what seems to us to be, you know, a golden opportunity.
Totally.
I mean, just though that description of that scenario, I think will leave a lot of people scratching their heads going, so these are Muslims, but who are gang members and drug addicts. Like, isn't that like a mutual contradiction? Like, but this is the kind of thing that people live with, all kinds of identities, I suppose, that they don't necessarily see in their context as somehow completely absurd, as we might think.
Yeah, and as I say, in Manenberg, everyone's officially something.
Right.
But it's fairly nominal.
Right, yeah. And a lot of these young guys, as you say, the stories you tell are often of guys from a Muslim background, but who are in the gangs and drug addicts and so on. You tell, yeah, there's one of them, Reswell, I think, in the book you talk about, and just the journey he's been on. Do you want to explain his story and the birth of the child, which was quite incredible as well?
Well, this is the thing. It's, again, like the message of the entire book, his is a life of spectacularly high highs and disastrously low lows, which he's still in currently. But he came to Crew 62. He was the first guy I met in Manenberg, and he came to Crew 62 he'd been offered a scholarship to one of the best schools in Cape Town, but heroin had got him 6 months earlier, and he'd started taking heroin. came to us and had a girlfriend at the time and a pregnant girlfriend. And during his time in Crew 62, the baby was due. And so we drove his girlfriend to the hospital and helped him be there. He didn't want to be present for the birth, but we said it was absolutely vital that he was. Yeah. He was. And halfway through the birthing process, he messaged me saying, "Pete, please pray. The baby, the heartbeat has stopped for the last 15 minutes. The baby's not alive. We need to pray resurrection over my baby." And so we got Crew 62 up and everyone in our little church community, and we all got praying. And about half an hour later, he wrote back just saying, "Praise God, she's alive." And so he'd seen this incredible miracle in front of him. And we'd just had a discussion in the car just before he'd gone into the hospital about how he'd been reading a book that he had explained to him for the first time ever what grace was. And he said, I realized
the reason for God.
The reason for God by Tim Keller. And you know, because he's an incredibly clever guy, and it was surprising that he was reading this. But he said, "I get it now. I get that I don't need to do anything to make God love me, but it's His free grace. I get it, and it changes everything, Pete." And I was like, "Wow, this is a huge day. Your baby's come back to life. You've just understood grace." And that was the Thursday. On the Monday, he left the house, and within a week had relapsed by drinking alcohol and then relapsed back onto heroin. And he's currently living on the streets. But again, we don't believe that's the end. We don't believe that's the end of his story.
Yeah, but it is indicative of the fact that this is like a messy story.
Right.
There are no kind of necessarily always happy endings and perfect sort of tied up stories of how this person went on to live some victorious life. People are people. And I get the sense that throughout this all, you've learned to kind of live with in the tension of the fact that it's a broken world that we live in, and you're kind of basically, as we've said before, fighting in a sort of supernatural battle, essentially. So what are some of the lessons you've learned in a more general way of living in that kind of environment and how to kind of reconcile the reality of this brokenness and the failures and tragedies you see with the hope, I suppose, of believing that the kingdom really is coming?
I think what we're learning is the redefinition of what we mean by the word success. People bang on about successful ministry and it does my head in. What do we even mean by that? If faithfulness to what God has asked us to do is the only measure of success, then we're 100% successful. Now, I will sometimes make and often make decisions that actually go against what I know God would want me to do. So in that sense, you know. But when someone once asked Sarah and I, "So what's your success rate with Crew 62? You know, it's a classic question and not an unreasonable one. Sarah just said, "Oh, 100%. And I thought, "Oh, you know, this is going to come back. What do you mean?" And she said, "Each person who's come in, and there have been 40 or 50 now over the last few years, each guy who's come in looking for love has found it in the face of Jesus through us and through our family. 100% successful." Yeah. And so we redefine success. And that's fine. Okay, great. But and we've realized we don't do something because it's effective. We do it because it's true.
And Jesus didn't look very successful when he was dying on the cross. And that's you know, success is redefined in Christianity in a pretty subversive way.
Absolutely. And so we seek to live our lives in the truest way we can in response to the example and life of Jesus. Now, of course, Jesus resurrected. He was victorious ultimately, and we believe that if we stick around, we will be. Yeah. We will see more lives changed. We'll see more evangelism through fascination, and we'll see a community totally transformed, but it won't happen in our timing or in the way we imagine.
But I guess, do you see yourself as somehow in that battle at this point between the cross and the ultimate resurrection, the ultimate new day of God, where what are you doing? What you know, because some might say, "It's brilliant what you're doing, Pete, but still a drop in the ocean, isn't it?"
Yeah, you know? That's a classic line.
What for you is the why does it make sense for you to give your whole life into just reaching X many people in that little part of Cape Town?
Because we have come to realize that it's less about the task we are doing and more about the people we are becoming.
Mm.
And the people we are becoming in this life of exuberant joy and tragic lows is a kingdom people. And there's beauty in that. And therefore, even if no one was to get clean or come to know Jesus, we know that the way we're living is the truest response we could come up with to the gospel in Cape Town.
I don't want to end before we hear also the story of, I think it's pronounced Marouane.
Marouane, yeah.
Because again, that's a story of great hope, but also a kind of a tragedy, but one which I think has quite shaped your community and what you do and the reason you do it. So do you want to tell us the story of Marouane?
Yeah, Marouane came to us, I think he was 19 years old, a heroin addict, born in a Muslim family, a gangster, and had actually emerged later on, had actually held up at knife point one of our church leaders, who 5 years prior to Marouane coming to us had prophesied over him as he was being mugged, that he was forgiven and that he was a child of God and that he, God had a plan for his life. Marouane came to us 5 years after that, cold turkeying off heroin, shivering, joint pain, fever, everything. And we were playing worship music in the house, and there was a song, No Longer Slaves, that was playing. The words, I'm no longer a slave to fear, I'm a child of God. And when the song ended, Marouane kind of croaked from his bed, play it again. We thought, okay, fine, he's a new guy, he can get what he wants. We played it again. He just kept saying, play it again, play it again. And we said, why? And he said, oh, when that song plays, my withdrawal pains leave. And then he came to a worship night that we hold around the corner, and that song was the opening song of the evening, and he jumped into the middle of the room. You know, bear in mind, he'd never been to church before in his life, as far as I could work out, and just said, won't you all pray for me? So we prayed for him, and at that moment, he received the gift of tongues, and the physical withdrawals of coming off heroin instantly left him. And he got saved.
Gosh.
And so that then his life was then in sort of fast forward. The next 15 months he was with us, he just grew astronomically, faith-wise and in every way you can imagine. And God gave him a vision of how he could be a change in his community as well, and decided, along with a friend and colleague of ours, to walk from Johannesburg to Cape Town, 1,500 kilometers over 60 days, 38 kilometers a day, to raise money and profile and shine a spotlight on the failing school system in Manenberg, so that young guys who were on the risk of being expelled, like he was, wouldn't be, and he could make a change.
Mm.
And on the second day of that walk, he was killed in a car crash. A car just drove into him on the hard shoulder and killed him instantly. And we were devastated. He was the first guy to come through the house.
Yeah,
he had he was the example of everything that we said Jesus would do in people's lives, because we knew him to be true, and he was cut down short. And
it felt like that must have stung even more in a way than the guys who relapse or whatever, because it felt like senseless and like, no, that's not the way that story's supposed to end, God.
And people come up with every theology they can. Oh my goodness, you know, well meant, but completely misguided of, oh, it was obviously his time to go, or someone even said to me, maybe it was because he was going to relapse one day and God, you know, took him away before he did. You know, people just, we make things
up, we try to kind of square the circle somehow.
Right. Yeah. And it was a robbery, and that's how we see it. But along with, as you were talking about, Jesus's crucifixion and death and the resurrection that came, we demanded souls for Marouane's life, and we prayed that over and over. And his mother and his sister and his brother have come to know Jesus, and we made a short film about his life that other friends have shown as they preached in churches, and people have come to know Jesus through it. And he speaks even though he's dead, and his legacy lives on. And I think that's the message. You know, you can kill us, but the message, the story of Christianity lives on and transforms.
And at the end of the day, there's a lot of people living but who aren't alive. And and Marouane at least experienced true life and continues to experience true life. But you're there for the people who are alive, but they're living in Death Valley at this point. And and those are the people you're continuing to try to reach, and not simply to reach in a kind of we're going to help you, but actually to be part next to them, part of that community, not as some kind of white savior coming in to save them, but very much saying, we're going to be brothers and sisters together on this journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Come and join Covenant Family. Come and do life with us. And as you come off drugs and as you leave gang membership behind, come and discover who God's really created you to be, because guarantee it'll blow your mind.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the challenge of what you've been doing with Sarah, Pete, out in South Africa. Thank you that you've put it down in this book, No Neutral Ground, Finding Jesus in a Cape Town Ghetto. It's available from Hodder. And we just wish you God's blessings as you continue to find where Jesus is leading you next, and encourage other people to step into their Manenberg, whatever it
right.
might be.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. My guest today was Pete Portal. You can find out more about the ministry. Where should they go, Pete, if they want to look you up online, a website, that kind of thing?
Tree of Life. The name of our church is treeoflife.org.za. And if they want more personal information and to order the book, they can go to peteportal.com.
Brilliant. Peteportal.com, good place to go for more. But thanks for being my guest on the show today. And if you're listening and you'd like to find more interviews with all kinds of interesting people like Pete, why not check out the archive of shows from the podcast? You're looking for The Profile wherever you get your podcast from. Give us a rating and a review as well. Always helps other people to discover the show. We'll be back again at the same time next week. And make sure to get hold of your copy of Premier Christianity Magazine, our sister publication, which brings you The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio every week. For the moment, thanks for being with me. We'll see you next time.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.